There were no pews or chairs, apart from some tall wooden seats built along one of the walls. We proceeded to the altar. I felt suddenly like an invader. But there were no sign of the monks, and Georgescu strode ahead with proprietary cheerfulness. The altar was hung with embroidered cloths, and in front of it lay a mass of woven wool rugs and mats in folk motifs that I would have called Turkish, if I hadn't known better. All this I made out with difficulty through the dusk, but the gloomy beauty of the scene moved me. I turned to Georgescu. "Did Vlad worship here? In the previous church, I mean."
"Oh, certainly. He was a pious old murderer. He built many churches and other monasteries. To be sure, plenty of people were praying for his salvation. This was one of his favourite places, and he was very close to the monks here. Oh, look, this is what I wanted to show you."
He squatted down and turned back the rugs in front of the altar. Directly before it, I saw a long rectangular stone, smooth and undecorated, but clearly a grave marker. My heart began to thud. "Vlad's tomb?"
"Yes, according to legend. Some of my colleagues and I excavated here a few years ago and found an empty hole. It contained only a few animal bones."
I caught my breath. "He wasn't in it?"
"Absolutely not."
Georgescu's teeth glinted like the brass and gold all around us.
"The written records say he was buried here in front of the altar, and that the new church was built on the same foundations as the old, so his tomb was not disturbed. You can imagine how disappointed we were not to find him."
Disappointed, I thought. I found the idea of the empty hole below more frightening than disappointing.
"In any case, we decided to poke around a little more, and over here..."
He led me back down the nave to a spot near the front entrance, and moved another rug.
"Over here we found the second stone just the same as the first, so we dug this up too."
I stared down, as Georgescu explained, patting it. "And you found?"
"Oh, a very nice skeleton. And a casket that had part of the shroud still over it. Amazing after 5 centuries. The shroud was royal purple with gold embroidery, and the skeleton inside was in good condition. Beautifully dressed, too, in purple brocade with dark red sleeves. The most wonderful thing was that sewn to one of the sleeves we found a little ring. The ring is rather plain, but one of my colleagues believes it was part of a larger ornament that showed the symbol of the Order of the Dragon."
My heart had lost a beat or two by this point, I confess. "The symbol?"
"Yes. A dragon with long claws and a looped tail. Those who were invested in the order wore this image somewhere on their person at all times."
I was struggling with warring emotions of regret and relief. So this was his grave, and the legends just had the exact spot wrong?
"Oh, I don't think so."
He smoothed the rug back over the stone.
"Not all my colleagues would agree with me, but I think the evidence is clearly against it."
I couldn't help staring at him in surprise. "But what about the regal clothing and the little ring?" Georgescu shook his head.
"This fellow was probably a member of the Order, too. A high-ranking nobleman, and perhaps he was dressed up in Dracula's best clothes for the occasion. Perhaps he was even invited to die, so that there would be a body to fill the tomb."
"I don't understand. With so much evidence, exactly why don't you think he was Vlad Dracula?" Georgescu countered cheerfully, patting the rug.
"It's very simple. This fellow had his head on. Dracula's was cut off and taken to Istanbul by the Turks as a trophy. All the sources are in agreement about that. So now I'm digging in the old prison for another tomb. I think the body was removed from its burial site in front of the altar to outwit grave robbers."
I was transfixed by all the questions I wanted to ask Georgescu. But he stood and stretched.
"Wouldn't you like to go across to the restaurant for supper? I'm hungry enough to devour a sheep whole. But we can hear the beginning of the service first, if you'd like. Where are you staying?"
I confessed that I had no idea yet, and that I needed also to provide lodgings for my driver. "There's a great deal I should like to talk with you about."
"And I with you.
We made our way back to the ruined prison. It devolved that the archaeologist kept a little boat below the church and could row us over, and that he would prevail upon the owner of the restaurant to find local rooms for us. Georgescu stowed away his gear and dismissed the assistants, and we returned to the church in time to see the abbot and his three monks, equally black-garbed, processing into the church through the doors of the sanctuary. Two of the monks were elderly, but one was still brown of beard and stood firmly upright. They walked slowly around to face the altar, the abbot leading with a cross and orb in his hands. His bent shoulders carried a purple and gold mantle that caught the glow of the candle flames. At the altar they bowed, the monks prostrating themselves full length for a moment on the stone floor, just over the empty tomb, I noticed. For a moment, I had the horrifying sense that they were bowing not to the altar, but to the grave of the Impaler. In a restaurant on the shore, we ate heartily of stews and salads served up by a timid girl in village dress.
And now that you've seen Snagov, where do you intend to go? Back to Istanbul?
No. I shuddered. I've got to return to Greece to attend a dig, actually, in a couple of weeks, but I thought I'd go for a glimpse of Tugoviste, since that was Vlad's main capital. Have you been there? Georgescu scraped his plate clean like a hungry boy.
Ah, yes, of course. That's an interesting place for any pursuer of Dracula. But the really interesting thing is his castle.
His castle? Does he really have a castle? I mean, does it still exist?
Well, it's a ruin, but a rather nice one. A ruined fortress. It's a few miles up the river Argeș from Târgoviște. I tell you what, I'll go along with you. I can stay only a couple of days, but I could help you find the fortress.
I thanked him sincerely. We agreed to start tomorrow. And now, my friend, I must blow out my light to sleep for the next adventure, of which I shall keep you apprised. Yours most affectionately, Bartholomew. My dear friend, my driver was able to take us north to Târgoviște today, after which he returned to his family in Bucharest, and we've settled for the night in an old inn. Târgoviște is a beautiful town, medieval still in character, and containing at least this one good inn, where a traveller can wash his face in clean water. We are now in the heart of Wallachia, in a hilly country between mountains and plain. Vlad Dracula ruled Wallachia several times during the 1450s and 60s. Târgoviște was his capital, and this afternoon we walked around the substantial ruins of his palace here. We ate our evening meal in a little pub near the centre of town. It is remarkable to see the peasants walking around in their native costumes among the more modern dress of the townspeople. The men wear white shirts with dark vests and tremendous leather slippers laced up to the knee with leather thongs, for all the world like Roman shepherds come back to life. The women, who are mainly dark like the men, and often quite handsome, wear heavy skirts and blouses with a vest tightly fastened over everything, and their clothing is embroidered with rich designs. Less than ever do I have a way to mail this, so for now, I shall keep it tucked safely in my bag. Yours truly, Bartholomew. My dear friend, we have, to my delight, succeeded in making the trek to a village on the Argeș. I walked all around with Georgescu this afternoon and discovered that a square in the centre of the village provides their gathering place with a well for the inhabitants and a great trough for the livestock. Under a ramshackle tree is the tavern, a noisy place where I've had to buy one round after another of unholy fire water for the local drinkers. Think of this as you sit at the Golden Wolf with your tame pint of stout. There are one or two men among them with whom I can actually communicate a bit. Georgescu says it's a day's ride up to the fortress and back, and no one is yet willing to take us there. They talk of wolves and bears, and, of course, vampires. Prikoliki, they call them in their language. More tomorrow. How I could use a good hour's talk with you, and in my, our, own language. Yours with devotion, Rossi. My dear friend, we have been, to my solemn awe, up to Vlad's fortress and back. I know now why I wanted to see it. It made real for me, in life, the frightening figure I seek in his death. I shall try to describe our excursion for you, as I wish you to be able to imagine the scene, and want a record of it myself. We set out around dawn, in the wagon of a young farmer here. Georgescu tried to engage him during our drive into the deep forest, but he sat holding his reins in silent despair, I thought, like a prisoner being led away to the block. I felt pity for the man, and what we were putting him through, against all the prescriptions of his culture, and resolved to give him a little extra remuneration at the end of the trip. We intended to stay the night, to give ourselves ample time to examine everything, and to try to talk with any peasants we might encounter who live close to the site. And to this end, the man's father had provided us with rugs and blankets, and his mother had given us a store of bread, cheese, and apples, tied up in a bundle in the back of the wagon. We rode slowly through the forest, because the road was rutted and pocked with holes, and because it began almost at once to climb uphill. These forests are very deep, dark inside, even at hottest noon, with the eerie coolness of a church interior. After we'd driven nearly half the day, we came out into an open field, green and golden, under the sun. We had risen quite high, and could look out over a dense vista of trees, sloping so steeply downward from the edge of the field that to step off towards them would be to fall sharply. From there, the forest plunged into a gorge, and I saw the river Argesh for the first time, a vein of silver below. On its opposite bank rose enormous forested slopes, which looked unscalable. In the afternoon, our way led up on steeper and steeper roads, and finally into a village that Georgescu said was the nearest to the fortress. Here we sat a while at the local tavern, with glasses of that very fortifying brandy which they call palinka. Our driver made it clear that he intended to stay with the horses, while we went on foot to the fortress. Eventually we left the fellow to his brandy, and the horses to their water, and went on our way with bundles of food and blankets on our backs. As we were walking along the main street, I thought of what I had seen, or believed I had seen, in Istanbul, and I felt a pang of uneasiness. The track soon narrowed to a small wagon road, and after this to a footpath through the forest, which sloped upward before us. Only the last stretch gave us a steep climb, and this we negotiated with ease. Suddenly, we were at the top of a windy ridge, a stony spine that broke out of the forest. At the very top of this spine, on a vertebra higher than all the rest, clung two ruined towers and a litter of walls, all that remained of Castle Dracula. Georgescu led the climb over tumbled rocks, and we stood at last in the midst of the ruin. The fortress had been a small one, I saw at once, and had long since been abandoned to the elements. The courtyard in which we stood had once had a deep well for sieges, and also, according to legend, a secret passageway that led to a cave far below on the Argesh. Georgescu believed he had identified the castle chapel at one end of the courtyard, where we peered into a crumbling vault. By the time our archaeological lesson was over, the sun hung just above the western hills, and the shadows of rock, tree, and tower had lengthened around us.
"We could walk back to the last village, but then we'll have to hike back up if we want to look around again in the morning. I'd still rather camp here, wouldn't you?"
I felt that I had much rather not, but Georgescu looked so matter-of-fact, so scientific, beaming up at me with his sketchbook in hand, that I didn't want to say so. He set about gathering dead wood from the area, and I helped him, and soon we had a fire crackling away on the flagstones of the ancient courtyard, carefully scraped clean of moss for the purpose. The sun set before our supper was quite ready, and when it dropped behind the mountains, the ruins were plunged into darkness, towers stark against a perfect twilight. Something, owls, bats fluttered in and out of the empty window sockets from which arrows had flown towards the Turkish troops so long ago. I got my rug and pulled it as close to the fire as I safely could. Georgescu was dishing up a miraculously good meal, and as we ate it, he talked again about the history of the place. Did Dracula have children?
Oh, yes, by two wives.
Georgescu scooped up a little more stew for me.
His first son was Mishneh the Bad, who ruled Wallachia at the beginning of the 16th century. Another charming fellow. Dracula's second wife was a Hungarian woman who was a relative of Matthias Corvinus, the King of Hungary. They produced a lot of Draculas.
Are there still any in Wallachia or Transylvania?
I don't think so. I would have found them if there were.
He tore off a chunk of bread and handed it to me.
That second line had land in the Székely region, and they were all mixed up with Hungarians. The last of them married into the noble Gitzi family, and they vanished too.
I wrote all this down in my notebook between mouthfuls, although I didn't believe it would lead me to any tomb. This made me think of a last question, which I didn't quite like to ask in that enormous and deepening darkness. Isn't it possible that Dracula was buried here, or that his body was moved here from Snagov for safekeeping? Georgescu chuckled.
Still hopeful, are you? No, the old fellow's in Snagov somewhere, mark my words. Of course, that chapel over there had a crypt. There's a sunken area with a couple of steps down. I dug it up years ago when I first came here. The villagers wouldn't speak to me for weeks. But it was empty. Not even a few bones.
Soon after this, he began to yawn enormously. We pulled our supplies close to the fire, rolled up in our sleeping rugs, and lay quiet. The night was chilly, and I was glad I'd worn my warmest clothing. I looked up at the stars for a time. They seemed wonderfully close to that dark precipice, and listened to Georgescu's snores. Eventually I must have slept too, because when I woke the fire was low, and a wisp of cloud covered the mountaintop. I shivered, and was about to get up to throw more wood on the fire, when a rustling close by made my blood freeze. We were not alone in the ruin, and whatever shared that dark, uneven hall with us was very near. I got slowly to my feet, thinking to rouse Georgescu if I needed to, and wondering if he carried any weapons in his gypsy bag with the cookpots. Dead silence had fallen, but after a few seconds the suspense was too much for me. I pushed a branch from our pile of kindling into the fire, and when it caught, I had a torch, which I held cautiously aloft. Suddenly, in the depths of the overgrown area of the chapel, my torchlight caught the red gleam of eyes. I would be lying, my friend, if I said my hair didn't all stand on end. The eyes moved a little nearer, and I couldn't tell how close to the ground they were. For a long moment they regarded me, and I felt, irrationally, that they were full of a kind of recognition, that they knew who I was, and were taking my measure. Then, with a scuffling in the underbrush, a great beast came half into view, turned its head this way and that, and trotted away into the darkness. It was a wolf of startling size. It took me some time to settle to sleep again. I managed only an uncomfortable doze, and was relieved to see that the dawn came early to that eagle's eyrie. It was quiet now, still rather foggy, and no wind moved the trees around us. As soon as the light was strong enough, I went cautiously to the crumbling vaults of the chapel and examined the wolf's tracks. They could be clearly seen on the near side of the chapel, large and heavy in the earth. The strange thing was that there was only one set of them, which led away from the chapel area, directly out of the sunken beds of the crypt, with no sign of how the wolf had made its way in there in the first place. Or perhaps I simply couldn't read its trail well enough in the undergrowth behind the chapel. Again I must stop for the present, but my warmest regards go out to you from a faraway land. Rossi. My dear friend, We returned yesterday afternoon to the village on the Argesh, and Georgescu has set off for Snagov with a hearty embrace and the wish that we may be in touch again some day. Having resolved to use my last free days here rather than hurry to Greece ahead of schedule, I've been relaxing a bit at the tavern, trying to improve my bits of Romanian, attempting, with poor success, to talk with the elders about the legends of the region. Today, I walked the woodlands near the village, coming upon a shrine far from any village. As I was returning, I met a young village girl who stood motionless in my path in her peasant dress, for all the world like a figure of history. As she showed no sign of moving, I stopped to speak with her, and to my amazement, she presented me with a coin. It was clearly very old, medieval, and showed on one side the figure of a dragon. I felt sure, although without proof, that it must have been coined for the Order of the Dragon. The girl, of course, spoke only Romanian, but I managed to learn from her that she was given it by an old woman. The girl also told me that her family name is Getzi, although she seemed to have no inkling of its significance. When I tried to return the coin, she seemed to insist I keep it, which I've done for now, though I shall certainly try again to give it back. We arranged to talk further tomorrow, and I must desist now to make a sketch of the coin and to study my dictionary in the hope of being able to ask her more about her family and their origins. My dear friend, last night I made a little further headway in speaking with the young woman I told you about. I was astonished by the quickness of her understanding as we tried to converse, and found that, in addition to great natural gifts of perception, she can read and write, and was able to help me look up words in my dictionary. She explained to me the startling fact that one member of each generation of her family is stamped on the skin with a tiny dragon. This, as much as her name, has convinced me that she is part of a living branch of the Order of the Dragon. I would like to talk with her father, but when I proposed this, she looked so distressed that I would have been a cad to pursue it. I'm off now to walk in the woods. I have so much to think about here that I feel I need to clear my head a bit. My dear friend, my only confidant. 2 days have passed, and I hardly know how to write to you about them, or if I shall ever show this to anyone. 2 nights ago, after I last wrote to you, I met again the angelic young woman I have been describing, and our conversations this time led to a sudden change. A kiss, in fact, before she fled. I was sleepless all night, and when the morning came, I left my room in the village and wandered into the woodland. In the evening, I made my way back again to our meeting place, thinking that if she came there again, I would tell her as well as I could manage that I owed her an apology and would trouble her no more. Just as I was giving up the hope of seeing her, she appeared among the trees. I opened my mouth to speak, and at that moment she flew across the gap that separated us and threw herself into my arms. To my astonishment, she seemed to have given herself completely to me, and our feelings soon brought us to a full intimacy, as tender and pure as it was unplanned. My dear friend, if it is still you to whom I write, I have lived 4 days in paradise now, and my love for the angel who presides over it seems to be exactly that. Love. Never before have I felt for any woman what I feel now, in this alien place. With only a few more days to think, I have, of course, been considering this from every angle. The idea of leaving her and never seeing her again seems to me as impossible as that I should never see my home again. I've now resolved to make her my wife as soon as possible. Our lives will no doubt be a strange path, but I am certain her natural grace and acuity of mind will carry her through whatever we encounter together. I cannot leave her here and wonder all my life what might have been, nor can I desert her in such a situation. I have all but decided that I will ask her tonight to marry me a month from now. I feel I must first attend the dig in Crete to which I have been invited, a nobleman's grave near Knossos. My future work may rest with these colleagues, and with it I shall support her and myself in the life we build together. After this I will come back for her, and how long 4 weeks of separation will be. It is my wish to see if the priests at Snagov might marry us there, so that Georgescu could be our witness. Of course, if her parents insist that we marry before we leave the village, I am willing to do that instead. She shall travel with me as my wife, in any case. Yours in joy and anxiety, Rossi.
When Helen and I stepped off the bus in Budapest, it was nearly evening already, but I realized with a feeling of shock that we had left this bus station the same day, that very morning. I felt I had lived a couple of years since that moment. At the front desk of our hotel, there was a note for Helen from her aunt, which she read eagerly.
I thought so. She wants us to have dinner with her this evening, here in the hotel. She will tell us her goodbyes then, I suppose.
Will you tell her?
About the letters. Probably. I always tell Eva everything, sooner or later.
We had scant time to wash and dress in our rooms before supper. I changed into the cleaner of two dirty shirts and shaved over the elaborate basin. And when I came downstairs again, Eva stood at the front window, her back to me, her face toward the street and the fading evening light. Seen this way, she had less of the formidable alertness and intensity of her public demeanor. Turning suddenly, she saved me the trouble of deciding whether or not to call out to her, and I saw worry in her face before her wonderful smile dawned in my direction. She hurried forward to shake my hand, I to kiss hers. A moment later Helen appeared, to my relief, and she translated us into the dining room, with its glossy white cloths and ugly china. I sat back, tired, while they spoke together for a few minutes. Helen lowered her voice, although few of the diners around us could have known English.
My aunt has made a discovery. Something that may be unpleasant for us.
What?
My aunt has been questioned about you. About us. She told me she received a visit this afternoon from a police detective whom she has known for a long time. He apologized and said it was only their routine, but he interrogated her about your presence in Hungary, your interests and our relationship. My aunt is very clever in these matters, and when she questioned him in return, he managed to reveal that he had been, how do you say, put on the case by Geza Joseph.
Her voice dropped to an almost inaudible murmur. Geza? I stared at her.
My aunt says he is a member of the secret police and can be quite dangerous to us. They do not like the liberal reforms of the government, and are trying to keep the old ways.
What does he want?
He apparently feels you are involved in more than historical research. He believes you have come here looking for something else.
He's right, I pointed out in a low voice.
He is determined to find out what it is. I am sure he knows where we went today. I hope he will not question my mother, too. My aunt turned the detective away from the scent as well as she could, but now she is worried. It's a good thing we are leaving Hungary tomorrow. She warned us not to talk with any strangers as we depart.
After we had told Aunt Eva an affectionate farewell, Helen insisted that we go for a last walk in Budapest.
We will stay in well-lit places, but I wish you to see the city one more time.
We wandered out onto the great bridge, and there, leaning against the railing, Helen told me that she had once thought she was in love with Geza Joseph, until he had boasted to her about his activities in the secret police. I sensed some complicated feeling in you. I thought perhaps you had loved him, or still loved him, something like that. She shook her head, looking down at the dark current.
No, I could not love an interrogator, a torturer, probably a murderer. And if I did not reject him for all this, there would be other things for which I would reject him. He is not kind. He does not know when to say something comforting and when to be silent. He does not really care about history. He does not have soft gray eyes or bushy eyebrows, or roll his sleeves up to the elbow.
I stared at her, and now she looked me full in the face with a kind of determined courage.
In short, the biggest problem with him is that he is not you.
After a moment she began to smile, as if in spite of herself, and it was the beautiful smile of all the women in her family. I stared, an unbeliever still, and then I took her into my arms and kissed her passionately. As soon as I could let her go for a second...
What did you think?
At the front desk of the hotel, when I asked for my key, the clerk handed it over with a scrap of paper scrawled in German. Tergut had called and wanted me to call him back. Helen waited while I went through the ritual of begging for the phone and giving the guard a little incentive to help me, and then I dialed hopelessly for a while until it rang far away. Tergut answered with a rumble and a quick switch to English.
Paul, dear man, thank the gods you have called. I have news for you, important news. The Lyrisolim found has been translated, and it is an astounding document. It was written by a monk of the Orthodox faith in Istanbul in 1477. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes! The clerk glared at me, and Helen looked anxious. Go on!
In 1477. There is much more. I think it is important that you follow the information of this letter. I will show it to you when you get back tomorrow, yes?
Yes! But doesn't it say they buried him in Istanbul?
I cannot tell from the letter. I am still uncertain where he is buried, but it is not very likely that the tomb is here. I think you must prepare yourself for a new trip. You will probably need succor from the good aunt again also.
Despite the static, I could hear a grim note in his voice. A new trip? But where? Tergut, far away.
To Bulgaria!
Tergut Bora and Selim Aksoy were waiting for us at the airport in Istanbul. Within an hour, we found ourselves at the door of Turgut's apartment, where Mrs. Bora was clearly delighted by our reappearance. She and Selim Aksoy served us coffee and something she explained was borek, a roll of pastry with salty cheese inside, as well as a dinner of five or six other dishes.
Now, my friends, tell us what you have learned.
This was a tall order, but together we filled him in on our experiences at the conference in Budapest, my meeting with Hugh James, Helen's mother's story, Rossi's letters. Tergut listened with wide eyes as we described Hugh James's discovery of his dragon book. Recounting all this, I felt we had indeed learned a lot. Unfortunately, none of it pointed to Rossi's whereabouts. Tergut told us in his turn that they had had grave troubles during our absence from Istanbul. Two nights before... His kind friend, the archivist, had been attacked a second time in the apartment where he was now resting. The first man they'd had watching him had fallen asleep on duty and had seen nothing. They had a new guard now, whom they hoped would be more careful. They were taking every precaution, but poor Mr. Erozan was very unwell. They had another kind of news, too. Tergut gulped down his second cup of coffee and hurried to retrieve something from his grisly study next door. He emerged carrying a notebook and sat down again next to Selim Aksoy. They looked gravely at us.
I told you on the phone that we had found a letter in your absence. The original letter is in Slavonic, the old language of the Christian churches. As I told you, it was written by a monk from the Carpathians, and it concerns his travels to Istanbul. My friend Selim is surprised that it is not in Latin. But perhaps this monk was a Slav. Shall I read it?
Of course. And he read us the following.
Your Excellency, Lord Abbot Maxim Eupraxius, a humble sinner begs your ear. As I have described, there was great controversy in this company since our mission failed yesterday. The city is not a safe place for us, and yet we believed we could not leave it without knowing what has become of the treasure we seek. This morning, by the grace of the Almighty... A new way opened, which I must record for you here. The abbot of Panakrantos, hearing from the abbot, our host, his good friend, about our sore and private distress, came to us at St. Irina in person. He held counsel alone with our host, and then they spoke with us in our host's chambers with complete secrecy, all novices and servants being dismissed from the chambers first. In brief, he revealed to us that what we seek has been transported already out of the city and into a haven in the occupied lands of the Bulgarians. He has given us the most secret instructions for our safety in travelling thither, and has named for us the sanctuary which we must find. Excellency, forgive our willfulness in setting out without being able to send for instructions from you, and may God's blessing and yours be upon us in this our decision. If it is necessary, I shall destroy even this record before it can reach your hands, and shall come to tell you with my own tongue, if it be not cut out first, of our search. The humble sinner, Brother Kirill, April, the year of our Lord, 6985.
There was a deep silence when Turgut had finished. Salim and Mrs. Boris sat quietly, and Turgut rubbed his silver mane with a restless hand. Helen and I looked at each other. 6985, what does that mean?
Medieval documents were dated from a calculation of the date of the creation in Genesis.
Yes, 6985 by modern reckoning is 1477.
I couldn't help sighing. It's a remarkably vivid letter and obviously full of great concern about something, but I'm out of my league here. What proof do we have that the monk who wrote this new letter came from the Carpathians? And why do you think this is connected with Vlad Dracula? Turgut smiled.
Excellent questions as usual, my young doubter. Let me try to answer them. As I told you, Salim knows the city very well, and when he found this letter and understood enough of it to see it might be useful, he took it to a friend of his who is the keeper of the ancient monastery library at St. Irina, which still exists. This friend searched the oldest church histories which he has there, and discovered that the abbot to whom this letter is addressed, this Maxim Eupraxius, was, late in his life, a great abbot on Mount Athos. But in 1477, when this letter was written to him, he was the abbot of the monastery at Lake Snagov.
Turgut uttered these last words with a triumphant emphasis. We sat in excited silence for a few moments. Finally, Helen broke it.
We are men of God. We are men of the Carpathians.
I beg your pardon?
Turgut gazed at her with interest. Yes, I took up Helen's line. Men of the Carpathians. It's from a song, a Romanian folk song Helen found in Budapest. I described to them the hour we'd spent turning through the old book of songs at the University of Budapest library, the fine woodcut at the top of that page, of a dragon and a church hiding among trees. Turgut's eyebrows rose almost to his shaggy hair when I mentioned this, and I rummaged quickly in my papers. Where is that thing? A moment later, I'd found my handwritten translation among the folders in my briefcase. God, I thought, if I ever lose this briefcase. And I read it aloud to them, leaving silences for Turgut to translate for Salim and Mrs. Bora. They rode to the gates, up to the great city. They rode to the great city from the land of death. We are men of God, men from the Carpathians. We are holy men, but we bring only evil news. We bring news of a plague to the great city. Serving our master, we come weeping for his death. They rode up to the gates, and the city wept with them when they came in.
Ye gods, how peculiar and how frightening.
He turned to Salim, and they exchanged a rapid fire of Turkish.
What?
Turgut combed his hair back with his hand.
Besides the letter, we found one other fact about Istanbul in this exact period. Something my friend Aksoy already knew, actually. In the late summer of 1477, in the hottest weather, there was what our historians call a little plague. It took many lives in the old Pera quarter of the city, what we call Galata now. The bodies were impaled through the heart before they were burned. This is rather unusual, he says, because normally the bodies of the unlucky ones were simply burned outside the city gates to prevent further infection, but it was a short plague and did not take so many people.
You think these monks, if they were the same ones, brought plague to the city?
Of course we do not know, but if your song describes the same group of monks...
Many Orthodox monks came through Constantinople on pilgrimage even after the conquest. Maybe this was simply a group of pilgrims.
But they were looking for something they apparently didn't find on their pilgrimage, at least in Constantinople. Tagut scratched his head.
Mr. Aksoy has thought about this. He explains to me that most of the great Christian relics in the churches of Constantinople were destroyed or stolen during the invasion. Icons, crosses, the bones of saints. If our monks were pilgrims, perhaps they came to the city in the hope of visiting a holy object, and then found it missing. Perhaps what the abbot of the second monastery told them was the story of a great icon that had been taken safely to Bulgaria. But we have no method of knowing from this letter.
I see now why you want us to go to Bulgaria.
I resisted again the urge to take Helen's hand. But, my God, I don't see how we can do this. Tagut leaned forward and set before me the English translation of the monk's letter.
He did not know, either.
Who?
Brother Kirill. Listen, my friend, when did Rossi disappear?
More than 2 weeks ago.
You do not have any time to lose. We know Dracula is not in his grave in Snagov. We think he was not buried in Istanbul, but here is one piece of evidence. Of what, we do not know, but in 1477, someone from Snagov Monastery went to Bulgaria, or tried to. It is worth learning about. If you find nothing, you have tried your best. Then you can go home and mourn your teacher with a clear heart, and we, your friends, will honor forever your valor. But if you do not try, you will always wonder, and grieve without relief.
He picked up the translation again and ran a finger over it, then read aloud.
It is most dangerous now for us to linger even a day, and we shall be safer even in our progress through the infidels' lands than we are here. Here, my friend, put this in your bag. This copy is for you, the English one. With it, here is a copy in the Slavonic, which Mr. Aksoy's monastic friend has written out. Furthermore, I have learned that there is a scholar in Bulgaria whom you can seek for help. His name is Anton Stoichev. Stoichev knows more about the medieval Balkans than anyone else alive, especially about Bulgaria. He lives near Sofia. You must ask about him.
Helen took my hand suddenly, openly, surprising me. I thought we would keep our relationship secret even here, among friends. She squeezed my fingers.
Then I will call my aunt.
Eva, what can she do?
As you know, she can do anything.
Helen smiled at me. At that moment, Turgut's telephone suddenly gave a screech. He bowed his excuses and went across the room to answer it, and Mrs. Borough began to load the remains of our meal onto a brass tray. Tagut listened to his caller for a few minutes, spoke in some agitation, and then replaced the receiver abruptly. He turned to Salim and addressed him in rapid Turkish, and Salim quickly put on his shabby jacket. Has something happened? Tagut smote his chest with a punishing hand.
Yes, alas, it is the librarian, Mr. Erozan. The man I left to watch him went out for a moment, and he called now to say that my friend has been attacked again. Erozan is unconscious, and the man is going for a doctor. This is very serious. It is the third attack, and just at sunset.
Shocked, I reached for my jacket too, and Helen slipped on her shoes, although Mrs. Borough put a pleading hand on her arm. Tagut kissed his wife, and as we hurried out, I turned once to see her standing pale and frightened at the door to the apartment.
Where can we sleep?
Barley and I were in our hotel room in Perpignan. A double room we'd gotten by telling the elderly clerk, too, that we were brother and sister. We couldn't afford separate rooms, and we both knew it.
Well?
We looked at the bed. There was no other place, not even a rug on the bare and polished floor. Something about this picture and Barley's failure at nonchalance made me laugh aloud, even while my cheeks burned, and then he began to laugh too. In hysterical laughter, we relinquished all the tension of the trip. My fears, Barley's disapproval, my father's anguished letters, our arguments. Years later, I learned the term fou rire, a crazy fit of laughter, and that was my first one, there in that French hotel. My first fou rire was followed by other firsts as we stumbled toward each other.
The borrowed apartment where Turgut had left Mr. Erazan was perhaps a 10-minute walk from his own. Turgut muttered and swore, I guess, under his breath. He had brought with him a little black bag, which I thought might contain medical supplies. At last we found ourselves climbing the wooden stairway in an old house. We tore up the stairs after Turgut, and he threw open a door at the top. The house had apparently been divided into dingy little apartments. In this one, a bed, chairs, and a table furnished the main room, and a single lamp lit it. Turgut's friend lay on the floor with a blanket over him, and from beside him a stammering man of about 30 rose to greet us. The poor victim's face was ashen. His eyes were closed, and his breath came in rattling gasps. There was an ugly tear in his neck, larger than when we'd last seen it, but the more horrible because it was strangely clean, if ragged, with only a fringe of blood at the edges. Turgut examined the wound without touching it. After a moment, he reached into the bag he had brought with him. I saw him draw from it an object already familiar to me. It was a vampire hunting kit, similar to the one he had given me in a study more than a week earlier. He opened it and took stock of the instruments inside. Then he looked up at us. He wiped his forehead with a big hand.
Professors, my friend has been bitten by the vampire at least 3 times, and he is dying. If he dies naturally in this condition, he will soon become undead. This is a terrible moment now, and I must ask you to leave the room. Madam, you must not see this.
Let me stay. I want to know how it is done.
He glared at her, then seemed to acquiesce without words, and bent again to his friend. I hoped still that what I had already guessed was wrong, but Turgut was murmuring something in his friend's ear. He took Mr. Erazan's hand and stroked it. Turgut, silent now, had placed a string of prayer beads on his friend's heart, which made the body quiver a little, and selected from the stained satin in the box a tool longer than my hand and made of bright silver.
I have never had to do this before, God save me, in my life.
He opened Mr. Erazan's shirt, and I saw the aging skin, the curling chest hair gray as ashes, rising and falling unevenly. Salim searched the room with silent efficiency and brought Turgut a brick that had apparently been used as a door prop, and this homely object Turgut took in his hand, weighing it for a second. He put the sharp end of the stake on the left side of the man's chest and began a low chant.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allah is great.
I couldn't, I knew, force Helen to leave the room any more than I could leave it myself, but I pulled her back a step as the brick descended. Turgut's hand was large and steady. Salim held the stake upright for him, and with a splintering, sucking thud, it went into the body. Sluggish blood welled around the point and smeared the pale skin. Mr. Erazan's face convulsed horribly for a second, and his body quivered. The stake went down to its hilt, and Turgut sat back as if waiting. His lips trembled, and sweat had sprung out all over his face. After a moment, the body relaxed, and then the face. A sigh came up out of his chest. His feet in their pathetically worn socks twitched and were still. I kept a firm hold on Helen and felt her shiver next to me, but she stood quiet. Turgut raised his friend's limp hand and kissed it. I saw tears running down his ruddy face, dripping into his mustache, and he covered his eyes with one hand. My first impression of Bulgaria, and my memory of it ever after, was of mountains seen from the air, mountains high and deep, darkly verdant and mainly untouched by roads. Helen sat quietly next to me, her eyes fixed on the small porthole of the airplane window, her hand resting in mine under cover of my folded jacket. I could feel her warm palm, her slightly chilled, fine fingers. I don't know anything about Bulgarian history, you know. I'm going to be lost here. Helen smiled. The airport in Sofia was a tiny place. I'd expected a palace of modern communism, but we descended to a modest area of tarmac and strolled across it with the other travelers. Nearly all of them were Bulgarian, I decided, trying to catch something of their conversations. They were handsome people, some of them strikingly so, and their faces varied from the dark-eyed pale Slav to a Middle Eastern bronze. The difficulties of obtaining a Bulgarian visa in Istanbul, a passage oiled in great part by calls from Aunt Ava's Bulgarian counterpoint in Sofia, had only increased my trepidations about this country and the cheerless bureaucrats who had finally, grudgingly, stamped their approval in our passports in Budapest had seemed to me already embalmed in oppression. Helen had confided to me that the very fact the Bulgarian embassy had granted us visas at all made her uneasy. The eyebrows of the young customs officer disappeared into his cap at the sight of our passports, and he took the passports aside for a few minutes to consult with another officer.
Damn!
Several uniformed men gathered around us, and the oldest and most pompous-looking began to question us in German, then in French, and finally in broken English. As Aunt Ava had instructed, I calmly pulled out our makeshift letter from the University of Budapest, which implored the Bulgarian government to let us in on important academic business, and the other letter Aunt Ava had obtained for us from a friend in the Bulgarian embassy. I don't know what the officer made of the academic letter and its extravagant mix of English, Hungarian, and French, but the embassy letter was in Bulgarian and bore the embassy seal. The officer read it in silence, his huge dark eyebrows knit over the bridge of his nose, and then his face took on a surprised, even an astonished expression, and he looked at us in something like amazement. This made me even more nervous than his earlier hostility had, and it occurred to me that Ava had been rather vague with us about the contents of the embassy letter. I certainly couldn't ask now what it said, and I felt miserably at sea when the officer broke into a smile and actually clapped me on the shoulder. He made his way to a telephone in one of the little customs booths, and after considerable effort seemed to have reached someone. I didn't like the way he smiled into the receiver and glanced across at us every few seconds. Helen shifted uneasily next to me, and I knew she must be reading even more into all this than I was. The officer finally hung up with a flourish, helped reunite us with our dusty suitcases, and led us to a bar inside the airport where he bought us little shots of a head-emptying brandy called Raikia, partaking thoroughly himself. He toasted friendship among the workers of every nation, refilling our glasses and his own. If one of us said something, some platitude about visiting his beautiful country, for example, he shook his head with a broad smile as if contradicting our statements. I was unnerved by this until Helen whispered to me that she'd read about this cultural idiosyncrasy. Bulgarians shook their heads in agreement and nodded in disagreement. When we'd had exactly as much rakia as I could tolerate with impunity, we were saved by the appearance of a dour-faced man in a dark suit and hat. The officer greeted him with deference and introduced him as our assigned guide to Bulgaria, explaining that we were privileged in this because Krasimir Ranov was highly respected in the Bulgarian government. Outside the airport, Ranov hailed a cab, which had the most antiquated interior I'd ever seen in a vehicle— black fabric stuffed with something that could have been horsehair, and told us from the front seat that hotel rooms had been arranged for us at a hotel of the best reputation.
I believe you will find it comfortable, and it has an excellent restaurant. Tomorrow we shall meet for breakfast there, and you may explain to me the nature of your research and how I can help you make arrangements to complete it.
His face had something familiar in it, too. I'd certainly never seen him before, but it made me think of someone I knew. This feeling persisted for me during that first day in Sofia, dogging me on our all-too-guided tour of the city. Sofia was beautiful, however, a blend of 19th-century elegance, medieval splendor, and shining new monuments in the socialist style. My sense of foreboding about our guide increased when I asked him if he could put us in touch with an Anton Stoichev and saw him recoil.
Mr. Stoichev is an enemy of the people. Why do you wish to see him? Of course, if you desire it, I can arrange this.
In these last years, I found myself remembering over and over my first sight of Anton Stoichev's house. Perhaps it made such a deep impression on me because of the contrast between urban Sofia and his haven just outside it. Or perhaps I remember it so often because of Stoichev himself, the particular and subtle nature of his presence. We stood before a gate while the dust settled around Ranoff's car. Helen was the first to press the handle of one of the old latches. Ranov hung sullenly back as if he hated being seen there. Inside, Stoichev's house was sinking softly into an uneven ground, part yard and part orchard. The whole house looked as if it had grown slowly out of the earth, and was now slowly returning to it, and as if the trees had grown above it simply to shade this process. The first floor had put out a rambling wing on one side, and on the other stretched a trellis. Under the trellis sat a wooden table and four rough chairs. I could smell herbs and perhaps lavender, fresh grass, and frying onions. Someone tended this old place with care, and I half expected to get a glimpse of Stoichev in monk's habit, kneeling with his trowel in the garden. Then a voice began to sing inside. It was not the baritone chant of the hermit, but a sweet, strong, feminine voice, an energetic melody that made even Ronoff look interested.
We swinete, no barden.
The singing stopped abruptly, and was followed by a clatter and a thump. Stoichev's front door opened, and the young woman who stood there stared hard at us, as if the last thing she'd imagined in her yard was people. I would have stepped forward, but Ronoff cut me off, removing his hat, nodding, bowing, greeting her in a flow of Bulgarian. The young woman had put her hand to her cheek, regarding Ronoff with a curiosity that seemed to me mingled with wariness. At second glance, she was not quite as young as I'd thought, but there was an energy and vigor about her that made me think she might be the author of the resplendent little garden and the good smells from the kitchen. She surveyed us with a sharp glance that had nothing to do with the innocence of her eyes, and I saw that under her quick interrogations, Ronoff even opened his wallet and showed her a card. Whether she was Stoichev's daughter or his housekeeper, did retired professors have housekeepers in a communist country? She was no fool. Ronoff seemed to be making an uncharacteristic effort at charm. He turned, smiling, to introduce us to her. We shook hands.
This is Irina Christova. She is the niece of Professor Stoichev.
When he told her that we were from America, her eyes widened and she looked us over very carefully. Then she laughed, although I never knew what that meant. Ronoff scowled again. I don't think he was capable of looking pleasant for more than a few minutes at a time. And she turned and let us in. The house took me by surprise. It might be a sweet old farm outside, but inside, in a dusk that contrasted strongly with the sunlight of the front walk, it was a museum. The door opened directly onto a large room with a fireplace. The furniture, dark, intricately carved bureaus set with mirrors, princely chairs and benches, would have been arresting in itself, but what drew my eye in Helen's murmur of admiration was the rare mix of folk textiles and primitive paintings, icons mainly, of a quality that in many cases seemed to me to surpass what we'd seen in the churches in Sofia. There were luminous-eyed Madonnas and thin-lipped sad saints, large and small, highlighted with gilt paint or encased in beaten silver. Irina led us out of the room and up a narrow flight of stairs. The door at the top of the stairs opened, and a white-haired man, small but erect, came out on the landing. Irina hurried to him, grasping his arm with her hands and addressing him in quick Bulgarian mixed with some excited laughter. The old man turned to us, calm, quiet, his face deeply withdrawn, so that I had for a minute the sense that he was gazing down at the floor, although he looked directly at us. I stepped forward then and offered my hand. He shook it gravely and turned to Helen and shook hers as well. He was polite, he was formal, he had the kind of deference that is not really deference, but dignity. Ronoff came up and shook hands with him too, patronizingly, I thought, disliking our guide more every minute. I wondered how on earth we were going to accomplish any kind of honest discussion, learn anything from Stoichev at all, with Ronoff hovering behind us like a fly. Professor Stoichev turned slowly and ushered us into the room. This room, as it turned out, was one of several on the top floor of the house. The doors to the other rooms stood ajar, and sunlight filtered into them through the green trees in the windows opposite and caressed the bindings of innumerable books, books that lined the walls and sat in wooden crates on the floor, or lay heaped on tables. Among them were shelved loose documents of all shapes and sizes, many of them clearly of great antiquity. On one wall of the sitting room hung a primitive map, painted, to my amazement, on leather. I couldn't help stepping toward it, and Stoichev smiled.
Do you like that? It is the Byzantine Empire in about 1150.
It was the first time he had spoken, and he used a quiet, correct English.
While Bulgaria was still among its territories.
Stoichev glanced at her, clearly pleased.
Yes, exactly.
Then he gestured to the chairs around a table in the middle of the sitting room, and we all sat down. Stoichev said nothing else for a while, although he looked intently at us. After a few minutes, thinking he might